Mrs. Mayanza, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to us.
Glad to be here.
This is actually our first interview here in the building. We have had board members come to VOA before and talk to us, but today we thought we should come and, you know, see, explore the board through you. We know you as one of the leading members of the board, and you have been a member since 2018.
So May of 2018, I was appointed by President Trump to be a commissioner. Uh-huh. So there's 9 of us commissioners that oversee the work, and we're appointed by leaders in Congress on the Democrat and Republican. So we're very much bipartisan. In fact, mm-hmm. we brag that we're the best bipartisan, maybe only. Well, really, we really don't find that these issues divide us on partisan lines mm-hmm. at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that we have heard from the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom members a lot, that yeah. you know, we're bipartisan.
Mm-hmm, very much so.
But you know, it's very interesting. Each time we talk to someone, the person representing the board describes the mission differently. Mm-hmm. It's the same. I mean, there is yeah. a lot of consistency, but right. the way people see their mission, yeah. their role. So I'm going to basically start this conversation with that question. You know, okay. how do you see your role in the context of American foreign policy?
Right. Well, I think the reason we were created and the mandate we have is so important, and I see it play out all the time, especially if you look at world events right now. So what we're really to do is to assess religious freedom conditions abroad and make recommendations to our own government. So we go to the White House, we make recommendations to the President, we make recommendations to Congress and to the Secretary of State. And the neat thing about what we do is we don't consider bilateral situation. We don't consider what's happening, say for instance, a country like Saudi Arabia. We don't consider what's happening around them, what's going on internally. We just call them out if they have violations of religious freedom, and we make recommendations based on that. So we really play this important role where we're not letting religious freedom get pushed aside for other reasons, because it's such a core part and making it a core part of our foreign policy.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So you, despite what's happening bilaterally, mm-hmm. despite what's happening strategically, geopolitically,
right.
you want...
We call a spade a spade.
Right, religious freedom to be on the table.
Right.
As a critical,
and a country should
value.
Be, you know, punished or called out if they have egregious violations of religious freedom, regardless of what else is happening in that country or what our relationship is like with them.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other entities with similar missions around the world? Who do you partner with?
No, we really, we partner with a lot of NGOs and a lot of governments that are willing to partner with us, but we really haven't seen anyone quite the same mandate that mm-hmm. we have. Mm-hmm. But we would be excited to see other countries follow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the Europeans don't have it?
You know, they have envoys, mm-hmm. And a lot of them do have, you know, send out somebody, kind of like the State Department has the Ambassador for Religious mm-hmm. Freedom, and right now with mm-hmm. Ambassador Brownback, they have similar envoy type, but they're not quite as independent as we are.
Yeah, that's the question that we have gotten to, like, what is the difference between what Ambassador Brownback does
right.
and what does, you know,
right.
isn't he doing what the commission should
yeah.
be doing?
No, it's really completely different. So he's actually an ex officio member of the commission, so he does join us from time to time. But what he does is he works within the administration and obviously has to consider those bilateral things that happen, and that he's part of a group of people that are making decisions about policy, where we're just calling out religious freedom, we're making recommendations for how the U.S. government can move countries towards religious freedom. And I think that's important to know. We have a goal in mind, which is to move them towards offering freedom, and then they can start seeing the benefits of that in their own country.
Mm-hmm. So as you said, you regularly work with the lawmakers and mm-hmm. policymakers here in Washington.
Right, we do events as well. We brief them, we brief their staff. We also do special events
yeah.
or special reports, like about religious freedom and mm-hmm. women or education. We did important work on the textbooks coming out of Saudi Arabia. So, you know, we also have we adopt religious prisoners of conscience to call out, tell the stories of people who are suffering because of their religion. And we also just launched, literally last week, a victims database. So we're going to be keeping track of victims in countries that we've recommended be countries of particular concern where there are victims of religious persecution. Mm-hmm. So you can go to this one website, look up people, learn more about who's in jail because of their religion.
We know that your reports are read widely. We know that because we've been covering the issue also for a long time. But your prescriptions are not always followed.
No, we find that they're not always easy.
Yeah. So the question is, you know, what kind of levers as a commission do you have to make sure that, you know, what you're recommending becomes a reality? And I'm sure that's like the biggest challenge for you, right?
It definitely is.
It's different
is.
To work with lawmakers and policymakers. Mm-hmm. But for regions like Central Asia, it's really the policymakers who are making the call at the end of the day, as far as we know. So.
Yeah, no, there are some countries that want to get off all of our lists. There are some countries like Uzbekistan that's that's trying to get off our lists. They'll talk to us about what they're doing. We can make recommendations to our own government. They're more interested in instituting those because they want to see the country move towards religious freedom. But there are other countries, you know, North Korea isn't listening to. China, you know, are not actively engaged with us. They're not. They don't want to get off our list. They probably wear it as a badge of honor, you know, so we have less opportunities. But still, even then, we're making recommendations to our government, things like you should sanction, like in Russia, you should specifically sanction people that are overseeing abuses for religious freedom and different things they can do to at least there'll be a consequence for people that are committing these violations so that that'll be a deterrent maybe to others to want to continue in that same way.
How often does your board get requests, let's say, from the U.S. government on, you know, to recommend something or to advise?
I think pretty regularly. Our staff is constantly, you know, in relationship with their counterparts at state and at Department of Defense and other places. We go. In fact, we were just there briefing earlier today. So there's a lot of interaction. So it's a pretty regular thing.
And you have these, you know, annual reports that a lot of people read, as I said. When, before they become public, do you show them to the U.S. government?
We sometimes do get recommendations. We do sometimes share information and ask for them to give their input, and we certainly collect information from a lot of different sources before we put it in. But we don't give editing ability to anybody. It's very much independent, our voice, what the information we've pulled together, this is what we believe are the best recommendations for those countries.
Well, I know that you were in Uzbekistan in September.
Yes.
And we believe that you had some productive meetings there.
We did.
How are you analyzing the current situation there?
Right.
Because the sense is that things are improving in general.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the Uzbek government isn't necessarily making any political changes to, you know, we don't see much of a policy change either
in
terms of the, in terms of religious freedom in Uzbekistan. But the overall assessment is that things are improving as far as we, you know, as far as the U.S. government is concerned. And also they're looking at this in the context of bigger sort of strategic goals in Uzbekistan.
Right. You know, we obviously there was this period of time where there was great progress that was very exciting, you know, and the government engaged with UN Rapporteur for Religion and Belief, Ahmed Shaheed, and put together this roadmap and made some promises and made some, guarantees that they were going to do certain things by a certain time. And it was enough for the State Department to take them off their country of particular concern list and put them on the watch list. You know, we didn't quite feel that it was time to do that. The commission has their own recommendations for that tier one list, we call it, which would be the CPC list. And we really didn't feel like that was enough, just saying I'm going to do stuff. We wanted to see it actually get done before we took them off the list. We would love nothing better than to take Uzbekistan off our tier one list or our tier two list, frankly. And we would if they follow through with the roadmap. And we really feel like if they did get off all of our lists, chances are they'd get more economic development. You know, they immediately would be seen as a more stable country for engagement and bilateral agreements. So for them, it's only up. There's only good things that would come from them moving towards religious freedom. But, you know, our main concern was really this 1998 law on freedom of conscience and religious organizations that they've promised to amend, and really they haven't.
And when you were there recently, who did you meet?
So we're able to meet with Senator Safayev, and you know he's been a great
main spokesperson
for religious freedom, And we really appreciate all that he's done and appreciate his enthusiasm and his hard work, you know. And we made it clear that we wanted to see the roadmap actually instituted like they promised. That we wanted to see these laws changed like they promised, and we're hopeful, but we haven't seen that change yet. We also were able to meet with Minister of Justice, Ombudsman for Human Rights, the Grand Mufti. We also met with the Deputy Governor the name Fergana. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was wonderful and was helpful in helping us understand even how it plays out locally. And so we had good meetings, and we appreciated that they were willing to dialogue with us. But we know there's still a little bit of a reluctance to move as quickly as I think they were hoping to move initially when they made all these guarantees.
And I'm sure you've been watching the way the Uzbek government has been evolving in terms of discussing mm-hmm. religious freedom yes. in Uzbekistan. So now we know that the government doesn't want hijabs, they want right. scarves, for example.
Right. It's yeah. like head coverings.
You know, yeah, head coverings, right? So we finally know
I don't think I heard the word
where
hijab
the government
once.
Stands. Because yes. for the longest time, Uzbek officials would say we have no laws restricting yeah. Beards or hijabs. But now we know that even, you know, President Mirziyoyev made it very clear recently that he prefers Uzbek-style scarves. He mm-hmm. thinks that Uzbek women look much better and, you know, the Uzbekness is better represented by wearing that Uzbek kind of, Uzbek-style scarves
right.
rather than hijabs. And then
yeah.
we also talked to the Grand Mufti, who you also met in Tashkent when he was visiting Washington this summer, and he also was very eloquent in explaining that it's really the scarves. Mm. And has that, the reason I'm asking is that, you know, how much time do you spend discussing beards and hijabs
yes.
with the Uzbek government? Because
yeah.
the conversation, general debate in Uzbekistan evolves around those two
yeah.
issues right now when it comes to religious freedom.
Right. We were, I know we've worked a lot on, spoken out a lot about the hijabs and the right that people should have to practice their faith, and that's a part of their faith. And so to expect, especially like, you know, a woman that's going into a school to study her faith to take her hijab off, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And so we're continuing to speak on that. And, you know, the beard shaving had just broken when we first came.
Mm.
So it had just happened. And you know, and then there was a reshuffling where people were fired and, you know, replaced. And
right.
everyone was kind of like, oh, it was a mistake. But then when we were there, we heard more incidents that perhaps there was ever other times that men had rounded up and forcibly had their beard shaved. And of course, since we've returned, we again have heard in a different city that beards have been shaved. So we're very concerned about why this is happening and how it's inconsistent, completely inconsistent with the roadmap and with the promise that they're going to move towards religious freedom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So when these issues are you know, asked about, when we inquire about these, let's say, controversies, you
mm-hmm.
know, with the Uzbek government, and we mention your reports, for example, the U.S. calls for more religious freedom in Uzbekistan, your commission, you know, not just by Uzbekistan, but by several Central Asian governments, is usually described or seen like in three ways, you know. One side thinks that this is a very American group, you know,
mm-hmm.
they don't understand us, they
right,
don't look into
right.
our sociopolitical context, they come and they preach and they tell us, you know, what is religious freedom, they explain us, we know what it is, we have our own patterns here, we have
mm-hmm.
our own, you know, mentality. So that's one way of seeing you.
Right.
And another way is, that you know that you paint the situation in white and black, and that
mm-hmm.
you don't really have a very constructive approach. That you know it's not like you're not prescriptive enough. That's
mm-hmm.
that's one criticism that we hear a lot towards your commission. And another one, which I think is very heavy, is like you know they see you as a heavily influenced Christian group.
Mm-hmm.
They see you as a hardline, even inflexible group of you know hardcore Christians who want to change the world, you know,
mm-hmm.
through these reports and
mm-hmm.
have some kind of a direct influence on the political systems in those countries. How do you respond to these
sure.
kind of things? Because I'm sure they mention this in
oh, sure.
conversations with
absolutely.
You.
You know, I think the first of all is we're really careful that we use Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights to be the bar, the standard. Everyone should have the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and belief. So, you know, we're not coming to a country in any way, shape, or form comparing them to the United States or comparing them to the Constitution of the United States. So we're comparing them to an international document. And we really do have the bar set for international standards. And we repeatedly said this in our meetings in Uzbekistan that, you know, the fact that there are 11 steps to get registered for a religious organization in Uzbekistan is not the normal. I mean, we talk about how hard it is to get registered in a place like Egypt, and there's one committee that approves houses of worship. So, you know, it's the standard in Uzbekistan for registration is far higher than the international standard. So we really do look at an international standard in how we assess countries. In terms of us being a Christian commission, if you look at our work over the last 12 months, 24 months, I think you're going to see very few. I mean, it doesn't seem like Christian-focused things much at all. You know, we've really been following the hotspots, and I think for a while the hotspots were against Christians in the Middle East. So that was a focus because that was a place that needed an attention. But the cover of our report, you know, this last year was the Uyghur Muslims in China, and then the year before it was the Rohingyas. And it wasn't because they were Muslims; it was because it literally was the worst human rights, religious freedom violations in the world. So I think our work speaks for ourselves, and I'm pretty proud of the work we're doing in Central Asia. I mean, I think most of our advocacy has been for Muslims. And really, you look at the Baha'is, we do so much for them, and advocating for them in places like Iran and other places. So being here, I don't get any sense that would be the case. I do think because Christians are evenly distributed around the world a little differently than some other faiths are, that sometimes the Christian, when we're calling out who's getting persecuted, it seems like they're kind of on every country's list, so they get mentioned a lot. But I certainly don't think that our work at all is biased.
And the board has never had any Muslim or non-Christian
members,
right? Oh,
sure, absolutely. Absolutely. Right now, we don't have a Muslim member, mm-hmm. But we do have a Hindu member. We do have a Buddhist member. In the past, we've had plenty of Muslim members, so we've really had a variety of religions represented, Jewish members on the board, on the commission.
In Uzbekistan specifically, I have heard, you know, in my own conversations with the officials that, you know, oh yeah, you know, they see you as a Christian interest. they mentioned that a lot, and, you know, judging, as I said, you know, them very differently politically and socially, especially they see, like, you know, they're very unfair, you know, they look at us as Christians. And then they also sometimes criticize you for promoting these foreign beliefs, for example, like Christian missionaries in Uzbekistan.
Okay.
When you were there recently in September, we know that you went to Tashkent region to some of the and met some of the members of the Christian community. So,
We probably had more meetings with the Muslim community than the Christian community in Uzbekistan, and we also really advocated for more of the Muslim community than we did the Christian community. The Christian community, the only time we really was about registration. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the missionary law, you know, where we say everyone should have the opportunity to follow their faith, and if it means sharing your faith, that shouldn't be against the law. And really, Islamic faith is very much a missionary faith around the world, and that's partly why it's been growing. And so that when we say missionary, right, that's really for all faiths. It's not just for Christians.
Just for Christians.
No, it's not. It's for all faiths.
And again, you know, I want to know more about your conversations with the Uzbek officials, because in especially the State Security Service and others who monitor the activities of these minority know, religious groups, as you know, they see them. They clearly see these groups as threats, you know, who are threats to the underlying social political sort of texture in the country, that, you know, we are Muslims, you know, this is a Muslim society, and, you know, having these new groups will just create some kind of tension, instability. So that's how they explain their concerns, let's just say that, you know. And how do you have these conversations? How hard it is for you to, I guess, to find the common, you know.
Well, what's interesting to me, because in most of the countries we visit, our focus is really the religious minorities. Because usually the religious majority is fine, they're taken care of by their government. So Uzbekistan is unique, in perhaps Central Asia, is that the majority religion is also dealing with a lot of overreach of government in regulating their religious affairs. And so so we really, like I said, advocate a lot for the Muslim community in Uzbekistan. And we really felt like from our government meetings that there was some fear of, you know, a couple times we heard, we don't want to be, you know, Afghanistan is on our border, we understand the extremism, and they really want to keep control, make sure that extremism doesn't grow in the country. But we know freedom of religion does not encourage extremism. What encourages extremism is actually the opposite, is really clamping down, making it difficult for people to practice their faith is much more dangerous than having an open society where people can practice their faith openly. And you know, as for we were interacting with Muslim leaders, with Muslim groups, and you know, we didn't pick up any really frustration from them towards the religious minorities in their country. So we really didn't see that tension between the groups. So to say that they're afraid of some of these small religions because they, or minor religions, because they're going to cause problems in the country, we have not seen any of those problems. You know, you're not seeing ethnic conflicts between different religions or those kind of things happening in Uzbekistan. So
you see a certain level of tolerance.
Right. And so there is no risk for the government to allow Jehovah's Witnesses, for instance, to practice their faith, their Christians practice their faith. We haven't seen any sort of problems that would suggest that it would.
It's, and what would you say to officials who say, well, we have more of them now? That we see as a threat.
Yeah.
You know, now we have more Christians in Chichik, for example, or
right.
in Dizah, or, you know, they are exploding. They use these kind of words, like there are so many of them, and they're weird people, and they, you know, and they're disseminating these crazy, dangerous ideas, and then the communities are afraid. The mahallas, you know, are worried about these things.
Yeah, we that's totally unfounded. We didn't really get that kind of feedback from the government meetings we had. But certainly, the people, when you look internationally, people of faith tend to be the best citizens. You know, people that are following a code of ethics, where they're trying to make their lives better. You know, they tend to be really loyal citizens and really a wonderful contributors to their communities. So I think the fear is misplaced of religion in general. And I think they would find that the more they allowed people to practice their faith, what they're going to find is a freedom, lack of tension, and that actually is going to encourage economic growth. That they're not going to see the things that they're afraid of. But there is this like history in this part of the world of clamping down on religion. That is really benefiting no one.
What is that, you know, where is that line between, let's say, promoting and supporting, right? We know that you support religious freedom,
right.
you want to promote, you do promote religious freedom, and then how do you make sure that various groups, whether they're majorities or minorities, don't necessarily think that you're their advocates?
Right. Well, I think, you know, for us, I think having an even playing field. You know, and part of it goes back to this 1998 law, where having the law, you know, not favor one religion or another, having the steps to being registered the same for all the religions, and not being afraid of religion, but certainly treating them all equally, that everyone has a right to follow their religion, or not religion if they choose to not believe. I think that people should have the right either way to be religious or not to be religious.
You obviously you study the environment of so many different countries. Your reports show that, and you obviously want accurate appraisal, and you want you know, workable recommendations. And we know that you talk to the government, you talk to the non-governmental sector,
right,
and civil society.
We did. We met with a lot of activists, a lot of organizations, Christians, Muslims, different faiths.
How do you determine their credibility? Like, who are credible sources for you?
Yeah, so we do work with our embassy that lives in the country, that has recommendations. We also, our own staff interact with people on the ground. We also keep in touch with organizations that do work in the country, as well as leaders in the country. So we definitely are very careful about the information that we get, that we report, and we do make sure that it's credible. Mm-hmm. And we get a lot of information we don't report because we can't, unless we can make sure that it's credible, we're very careful to keep it out of our reports.
I mean, for the longest time, from the countries of Central Asia, because we do read these reports religiously, one of the main sources would be Forum 18, and you did mention Article 18, and we know who Forum 18 are, what kind of an organization. You look at them as a credible source.
Right.
Has the region improved in terms of reporting on religious freedom?
I think so. We certainly are getting better information out. We do know that even we met with some bloggers when we were in the country, and they're able to speak out about conditions and what they agree with and not agree with. And we do want to point out that, you know, they said things are better in the sense that they're able to speak about the conditions without government reprisal. And that's an important point. And in some countries, it's hard to get information because that isn't, people are too afraid to talk at all. You know, so we talk about the things we want to change in Uzbekistan, It's because we do see that good things have happened. The fear is that we're afraid that they made all these immediate changes that were positive, and then they're going to stop thinking they've done enough. And we really hope that they will just keep making changes, and especially this 1998 law, religion law, that they promised that they would redo, that they'd make the registration easier, that they'd take away the criminality of some of the charges against people that are practicing without registration, things like that. And, you know, also the other thing we haven't brought up is really the political prisoners.
Right.
How many people are in prison. Mm-hmm. You've been trying to get numbers. It's hard to know for sure because they've been accused of extremism or for some other violation having to do with religious freedom. We appreciate the president did release so many prisoners, and we were able to meet with some, and, you know, it was really encouraging to see them going in that direction. So we're hoping they close, of course, the prison.
Mm-hmm. Just like.
So we're really happy to hear these positive things. And I think one of the other important things we heard is that people, you know, that are gathering that aren't registered because they're not able to get registered haven't been getting raided. They're not getting arrested. So there seems to be a little bit pullback from some of those previous years where they were pretty harsh. And so when we see these positive things, it encourages us to think, well, if they just move a little bit more and they make these changes to the laws they promised to make, they follow that roadmap, we would love to take them off our list. Mm-hmm. But we can unless we actually see those things happen.
Why do you believe, labeling a country, you know, mm-hmm. a country of particular concern works? Because mm-hmm. if we were to look at, again, Central Asian cases, you know, either these countries get waived of those restrictions because the White House and the State Department and others think that they need them for
right.
other strategic purposes.
Right.
And secondly, it also creates a certain stigma, and then countries resist because they don't like to be labeled. You
right.
know? So what is the benefit of this, I guess, of having countries under this kind of status, calling them a country of particular concern?
Well, I think it's a way of really, in some ways, rewarding the countries that are doing it right, separating them from the countries that aren't doing it right. Because it's, you know, so many of these countries are insular. They don't understand that their practices are not the international norms. Like, Uzbekistan has been operating with these kind of laws for so long that most people in the country probably don't understand that the rest of the world doesn't live the way they do. They have less freedoms than other people around the world do. And so for us, calling it out, and I think the reason the law was written in 1988, the Religious Freedom Act in the United mm-hmm. States that formulated USURF, the commission, as well as the State Department's Office of Religious Freedom, and the CPC system itself, was really part of that. This is a way that we can call out the countries, but there's the nice thing about it is we make recommendations. There are things they can do to move off these lists. And as we've seen with Uzbekistan moving from a CPC to a watch list, by just showing progress, you know, and if they actually follow through with their progress, they could get off the watch list. And we might have a little bit higher standard over at the commission, but we also want to see countries come off our list.
Mm.
And so for us, I think it's a fair way of distinguishing, you know, what laws are good and what ones aren't. Because so much of the time, at the end of the day, it comes down to the laws. Mm-hmm. Countries, the laws really end up influencing the way that countries move towards religious freedom.
Mm-hmm. And so do you have other ongoing conversations like this with the other countries of Central Asia? We know that you have been quite active on Uzbekistan, mm-hmm. the neighboring countries, Turkmenistan, for example, Tajikistan, where
right.
also there are more concerns on
right.
Religious freedom.
You know, some countries are less interested in dialoguing than others. So
mm-hmm.
there are some countries that are almost proud of being a CPC, I think.
And naming and shaming
yeah.
works, huh?
You know, it does for some, and they take pride in the fact that they oppress their people and they're strong men, and they have that that reputation. But for countries that want to grow economically, that want to be a part of the international community, that want to be a part of the world trade, that want to be able to enjoy the prosperity other countries are enjoying, being on this list is not helpful for them. And so the best thing they could do if they really want all those things for their own people is to move towards religious freedom, get in a position where they're getting off our list so that they'll be able to better enjoy the things that will really help make their country prosperous.
Mm-hmm. In our conversations again with the officials, we don't see much recognition of what you're saying, that, you know, if you have more religious freedom, there are more economic benefits.
Mm-hmm.
There are many officials, policymakers, who argue they're not relevant at all. Mm-hmm. That, you know, a country's religiosity or level of religious freedom doesn't necessarily determine how transparent the country mm-hmm. is economically or how promising it is financially for foreign investors.
Yeah, no, we've absolutely seen countries. If you look at the CPC countries, most of them have pretty depressed economies, and even ones like China that seem to be an economic powerhouse. When you look at living conditions among their people, it doesn't seem to reflect in a quality of life for the average Chinese person who isn't enjoying in the wealth. It's really more of the elites in that country that are enjoying the wealth. And so I think that by looking at these countries, it speaks for itself that there's definitely benefits to not being called out for your religious freedom violations.
What is your argument against this uniqueness argument that you hear from governments, you know, various governments again and again? For example, again, Uzbekistan mm-hmm. or Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, we hear more of this there, from there too, who say, you know, we are Muslims, but we're unique Muslims, we're mm-hmm. different Muslims, you know, don't look at us the way you look at Pakistan, don't look at us the way you look at, you know, Iran, look at them, they're very different, look at us, you know, we're secular, and to maintain that secularity, we have to take certain measures, we mm-hmm. have to take certain steps. So if we have to call hijab a scarf, we will, but
mm-hmm. just let them wear them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so that is your argument.
Sure, right? Call them a scarf. Mm-hmm. You know, the words that are used, I understand that I buy into every country's got to do it their own way. Mm. You know, and that's why the roadmap was so great, because it was a roadmap they did with the UN rapporteur, you know, because they have to figure this out for themselves. So no one's saying this is how you do it, this is what you have to do, and we'll only support you in this way. We're very flexible, and this is your country, and you need to figure out what works for you. But people deserve their human rights. They deserve their rights to freedom, religion, and belief. And that has to be part of it. And so how is that going to play out in your country? And in that respect, there should be some consistency around the world that everyone should have these rights. But yeah, I think in how it all plays out, it's going to be unique, and I really respect. I was in Uzbekistan. It's a beautiful community. I certainly would want it to be freer and to continue to be a beautiful community.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you obviously know how the historic perspective into this, right?
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
right.
We are, like, you know, Uzbeks are very proud of their ancient Islamic heritage. The government now very proudly explains its religious educational efforts, mm-hmm. something that the government was criticized for a long time, you know, for the lack of religious education. Do you see progress? I mean, as the government points out, we have now more religious schools, we have academies, we have lyceums, we have special schools mm-hmm. where, you know, they're opening specific schools that are studying specific schools in Islam, mm-hmm. for example.
We see that at the higher level, like post high school, mm-hmm. and we're glad to see that those opportunities for people that want to study their faith, either as a career or as in a more serious way as they get older, but we do see that it's tougher for people that either are not going to go to college or people that are younger than that. You know, like right now, there's they forbid the private teaching of religion. You know, so you can't have a Bible study at your home. You can't have a gathering of people to talk about their faith at your home. That's really severe when you look around the world at the rights people have to practice their faith. You know, if you say that you want to become a Muslim, you're not a Muslim, or your family is pretty secular, but you want to take your faith to a different level and you want to start meeting with a teacher to teach you more about the Quran, you can't do that. If you want to, at the same time, if you want to become a better Christian, you want to start studying with a pastor and have him tutor you, you can't do that. So the private teaching of religion, we asked a lot of questions about that. We really didn't get a lot of information about why they're so strict on that and what's dangerous about teaching, letting someone learn from someone else about religion. So there are things like that that seem to not really make a difference for security, but do impact the way people are able to live their lives, that really doesn't have a positive way in society. But we're glad to hear of these other schools opening and some acceptance about that.
So when challenged on those issues, the government very quickly says, well, you know, qualified people should be doing that. Not everybody qualifies.
Yeah, we did hear that.
Right, yeah.
Right.
And then secondly is, well, that's exactly how extremist groups infiltrate the grassroots, you know, the bottom.
You know, I think that the radicalization is more likely to come in the shadows. you know, when people are not allowed to do things and they sneak around to do them and they feel oppressed when they're doing it, that's a situation that would, to me, be more dangerous for incubating extremism. For people to openly practice their faith and go places and meet together, that isn't a setting that's going to cause security concerns. That's not an incubator for radicalism. So, you know, I think that their desire to stay secular has gone so far that it's having the opposite effect that they want it to have on the communities that they're most afraid of.
Hmm. One more question. Thank you so much.
No, sure, of course.
For your time with us. We really appreciate it.
I'm so glad to have this conversation. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. The role of the Muslim board,
yeah,
it has been around for a while, and we've seen more activism, more appearances, more speeches, more statements from the Muslim board, from the Grand Mufti, for example. He's been traveling lately around the world, also trying to explain current policy and how they see it. By law, they're a non-governmental body,
mm-hmm,
but many, many Uzbeks see them as part of the government. They see them as the Muslim regulator in Uzbekistan. Do you look at them as a credible entity?
You know, they certainly are, you know, the government has put them in this situation where they can, you know, oversee the mosque and imams. We were just told when we were in the country that the government at the highest level had pulled together imams along with the Muslim board from all over the country and brought them to Tashkent and had an all-day meeting with them where they urged them to not push hijabs or head coverings to, or the growing of long beards. They also encouraged them for their Friday prayers to teach morals and not religion. It was fascinating to hear that they're going to such extremes to clamp down on just the teaching of faith in general. And so that was kind of a surprising development that we heard about when we were there. And that they are trying to monitor the teachings for the Friday prayers.
Mm. When you have those kind of conversations there, and then you come to Washington, mm-hmm, and then the members of Congress who are, mm-hmm, working with the region want to talk to you, what kind of questions do they usually raise?
Some of the same ones you have.
Yeah.
You know, they want to understand better why the government's making the choices they're making and what they can do to help move the countries towards religious freedom. You know, I think Uzbekistan's been an important partner. I think the United States has a good relationship with them. I think there's a lot of excitement for these changes and with the new president. And there's so much possibility that I think there's a little bit of fear that it would be a missed opportunity to to not encourage Uzbekistan the most we can right now to move in the right direction, mm-hmm, to continue moving, I should say, because they are moving in the right direction. It just seems to have slowed down almost to pause. Mm-hmm. And we would love to see another spurt of changes, especially with this law.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We know you're based in Pennsylvania, so you, mm-hmm, you commute from there. And
yep.
you, as you were telling me earlier, you spend a lot of time in Washington because obviously there's a lot of work.
Yeah, so there's a lot to do here.
Does the fact that, you know, the United States has a religious vice president and the religious secretary of state, mm-hmm, help you to do your work?
You know, they certainly, you've seen the prioritization of religious freedom with this administration. So there's no doubt that their commitment to their faith is helped to lead the administration towards advocating for faith. But I think it's important to note, too, that, I mean, if you look at Ambassador Brownback, the, you know, Ambassador of Religious Freedom, I mean, he's on the ground just nonstop, but he is equally advocating for all faith. And so I think even though you might see
so it's
Christian
not like
leaders,
everybody's concerned about Christian rights here.
I mean,
Washington.
I think we talk about the Uyghur situation as much as all Christian situations as a whole right now because it's so troubling and it's so, you know, and we're afraid the influence it's having on some other countries nearby. And I think the focus coming from, even though they might be Christians themselves, has been a very much all religious because it really does work that way. It's got to be all or none. You can't have one religion have any sort of special rights because what happens is it causes all sorts of problems with countries. And so we definitely all have been advocating, but it seems lately we've been advocating a lot more for Muslims just because, mm-hmm, of the situation that we're seeing around the world right now with these cases, in particular Myanmar and China.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the commission, just like many other similar entities, is funded through the U.S. Congress on an annual basis.
Right. And the commissioners are volunteers. So we don't actually work here. We all have different things that we do, and we volunteer our time just to serve because of the issue.
How often do you meet?
We meet together once a month, together as a commission, but we all come and go a lot between the months. So it's not like that's the only time we're here.
Yeah. So what else do you do other than being a member of this commission?
So for myself, I work with an advocacy organization, and I also work on different policies having to do with working family policy in the United States, and so and also faith engagement with different organizations, helping them think through how to engage with other faiths. So I do a lot of that domestically as well as internationally.
Mm-hmm. Do you also work with the Muslim communities here?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Hey, well, thank you for having me.